SaaS Backwards is sponsored by Austin Lawrence Group, specializing in demand gen for SaaS. It sure is noisy. I deleted 100 emails from vendors just this morning. Your buyer has gotten better at ignoring you, and you're going to need a big idea if you want to cut through all that clutter. Austin Lawrence is just the right agency to help you find it. So if your campaigns are falling on deaf eyeballs, let's talk. Visit austinlawrence.com today, and let's build something bigger.
Welcome to the SaaS Backwards Podcast, where we reverse engineer the success of fast-growing SaaS firms and explore strategies CMOs and CEOs are using to drive their businesses forward.
Welcome to SaaS Backwards, a podcast that helps SaaS CEOs and CMOs to accelerate growth and enhance profitability. Our guest today is Brent Adamson, Global Head of Research, Advisory, and Communities at Ecosystems, a SaaS platform for collaborative customer value management that helps its users to quantify and align with customers on the business value being delivered. Many of you may know his work as co-author of the books, The Challenger Sale and The Challenger Customer, and we're super psyched to have Brent as our 100th podcast guest. Hey, welcome to the podcast, Brent. How are you?
I'm great, Ken. Thank you so much.
Thanks for being here. And really, we are psyched to have you as our 100th guest. We're big fans of your writings and try and guide our clients to think along the lines that you and your co-author, Matthew Dixon, have laid out. So thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
Hey, before we get started, please tell us a little bit more about yourself, about Ecosystems, and it sounds like a great move for you.
Oh, yeah, sure, Ken. So very briefly, you know, the last 20 years of my career, and there's a whole nother career before that, but the last 20 years of my career has really been a professional researcher, writer, author, presenter at a company called Corporate Executive Board, which then became CEB, which was acquired by Gartner, and did that again for about 20 years, writing in sales and B2B sales, B2B marketing, and really something we'll talk more about today, I'd imagine, B2B buying. And for the last year and a half or so, I've been at a company called Ecosystems. Ecosystems.io is the website. We are a software platform designed to help particularly SaaS companies, but really just any large company, engage their customers in a much more collaborative value-based conversation. So you think about how do you define value with your customers, something we can explore in a little more detail, rather than just sort of showing up with an ROI calculator and saying, here's how much money we can make you or save you. How do you turn that into a dynamic, ongoing conversation that spans time, spans silos in a way that's captured and allows for things like value realization? It's a very slick, very powerful sort of environment to enable all that.
Well, you touched on two things that are kind of near to my heart. One is, you know, I'm not a huge fan of ROI calculators, maybe for corollary reasons or similar subset of reasons that you might be alluding to, just because people fear loss more than want gain, kind of psychologically. And I don't think they're the most powerful ways to get people to move. But also, as we talked before, it's really hard to sell value unless, I guess, you're well-armed. So can you just dig in a little bit more on that?
Well, you know, the thing I've learned, particularly, you know, moving over to Eco in the last year and a half is, as I've dug much deeper into this value world, which is sort of part of, I guess, the B2B sales, it's a little adjacent part of it, is that there's a tendency for a lot of us when we're trying to sell our value to do exactly that, to sell our value. So just like we might show up and throw up with products, so forgive the reference, it's pretty common in sales as we know, or I tend to show up and throw up with a calculation, like look how much money I can make you or save you. And we think that somehow by making customers more confident in the ways that we're going to produce value for them, that somehow that's going to make them buy. What I've found at a high level, Ken, is what'll happen is that you'll show the calculation, the ROI, the, you know, the lifetime value, whatever acronym you might be using, to your customers. More often than not, they'll look at it and they'll agree to the numbers. They won't dispute the math, but they'll dispute the relevance of the math. They'll look at it and say, yeah, but you know, we've decided to go in a different direction, or I'd buy this if I could today if it were just up to me, but you know, as a company, we're just not ready. Or my CFO's looked at this and she's got some different questions. And what you find ultimately is that our friends at a couple of our client companies have a great phrase. They say the math is last. And I think that's right, because if you just show up with the math being first, it's very much like challenger, don't lead with, but lead to. You can't lead with the math, you got to lead to it. Because ultimately what you find is, I think the value calculation really isn't so much an input of customer deliberation, but an output. So in other words, you know, we think like, if I'm going to show you the math, you're going to be more confident, you're going to buy, because you're going to be more confident in me and you're going to buy. But what customers need to be confident in isn't so much you, but themselves, and really their alignment around what I call objectives, tactics, metrics, targets, timelines, which is just a fancy way of saying, what are we even trying to do in the first place? Because if we're not agreed as a buying group on our objectives and how to get there and how to measure them, what our targets are, then your math is kind of irrelevant, because that math has to exist in context, and you have to set the context before you set the math. That's kind of the way I think about it.
So that's a whole, as we like to say, a whole nother way of looking at maybe the ROI calc doesn't belong on the homepage of your website, right? So maybe we have to lead people to want to learn more.
Or maybe the value calculation belongs on your website, but not so much as a, here's the calculation already done and dusted for you, but rather as an interactive tool. So that you could say, you know, the five objectives I could pursue, which of these three matters most to me? And here's some guidance on how other companies like you are thinking about it. So imagine if your website was essentially a conversation where it helps you and guides you and frames your thinking around objectives, tactics, metrics, and targets and timelines, such that in the end, the output of that exploration on your website was a value calculation, as opposed to I just go to your website and there's the value calculation. So this collaborative, interactive idea is really where you have to co-create not so much the calculation, you've got to co-create a vision of what you're even trying to do in the first place. And that's where I think there's huge opportunity in digital for that.
And so this is also the larger sale, right? The enterprise relationship sale. This is where this happens.
It's where it could happen. I think naturally it does happen in like really big accounts. Yeah, you know, the multi-billion dollar accounts that span geographies, whether it's global accounts or key accounts or whatever you might call them in your company. I think it happens naturally because there's just so many people involved on both sides. But there's no reason why this shouldn't happen in, heck, all the way down to the consumer world or like, you know, PLG. I think the larger play for a lot of product-led growth is, look, if I just make this $10 a month, it'll be small enough that you won't really worry about it. So I don't need to do a calculation. But at some point, it starts to add up. And eventually, when you tip from PLG into enterprise and you start selling, you know, 100 of those subscriptions to a client, a company, as opposed to one subscription to a person, then you're automatically beginning to talk about these things. So it's a muscle I would build sooner rather than later.
I think that's a great insight to share here, because a lot of the folks that listen are doing the PLG play, hoping to grow up, right?
Yeah.
So it makes a lot of sense. I want to go back toward the challenger sale, the challenger customer. And this is work that's really informed my own work, my own practice. So thank you. And I want to ask you, though, how your thinking might have evolved on these constructs, challenger constructs, as I've called them, over the last few years. Because this material, you know, that's in my hands anyway, is, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old, right?
Oh, believe it or not, it's actually much older than that. It's crazy. So the original research that we ran for Challenger, we did in 2008 into 2009, and then the book came out 2011. So that is, you know, depending on how you count it, somewhere between 11 and 12 years old, if not a little older. Now, that said, particularly the Challenger company, with which I am not affiliated. So we set up a Challenger training company within CEB. Again, that was acquired by Gartner. I think Gartner spun that company out. So full disclosure, I have no affiliation legally or financially with the Challenger IP or body of work anymore at all. But I still think it's right. But we'll talk about how it could evolve. The thing that's interesting, though, just real briefly, although it's 12 years old, is, of course, the Challenger company has been out running training programs with hundreds of thousands of reps all over the sellers all over the world. And it continues to be corroborated, the baseline data findings. We have yet to find an anomaly or a geography where it doesn't apply. So I think that's actually pretty powerful. I think it's got some real staying power, which is why it's still around after all these years and people still pick up the book. First of all, it was never meant as a methodology. It's kind of what it's become, right? But what it was meant was simply as a research project. We were just doing research, trying to figure out what sets the best sales, the sellers apart from everyone else. And we identified this subset of behaviors really that they engage in. And we gave it a name and started talking about it. And eventually that became a book and that became Challenger. What's interesting, of course, is that it's had humblingly just incredible impact, right? I mean, it's kind of made its way around to just about everywhere, which is crazy to think about. And so there's another phenomenon that happened at the same time. I think it's, I joke, somewhere around 2015, virtually every CEO woke up one morning and said, we're having a hard time differentiating ourselves. And they all looked in the mirror and said, I know, we'll become a thought leaders, because if we're a thought leader, that allow us to stand out in the marketplace and show our customers or potential customers that we have smart things to say. And then marketing kind of got on board with something called content marketing, as we know. And shortly thereafter, there's marketing automation. And now we have better data than ever before. So now we can spam the world at scale with huge amounts of high quality content, all following the mandate of our CEO. So where that all gets us, Ken, is a world today that was very, very different than, say, 12 years ago, where most sellers were still showing up and saying features, benefits, products, speeds, feeds. And I think a lot of us still fall in that trap today. But nonetheless, the word that I use to really describe how the world today is very different than, you know, early Challenger days is the word context. Because we need to understand when we show up with this insight, which is the core idea of Challenger, and challenge our customers' thinking, show them a new way to make money, save money, mitigate risk. It used to be, I'm speaking in generalities here, but largely speaking, 12 years ago, that was a very unique way to sell. It used to be there's very few other people creating that kind of engagement with customers. Today, you know, in this world of thought leadership and content-led creation, I call it the smartness arms race, where everybody's trying to be insightful. Everybody's trying to teach customers something new, whether it's Challenger or not, whether they've read the book or not, whether it follows the tenets of the Challenger sale. We're all leading with insights and content and ideas and thought leadership. And so what happens today is many times we're seeing customers aren't seeing your insight and saying, oh, wow, I feel like I got to do something different. They're saying, oh, wow, there's another thing I got to worry about. So the overall impact on customers is less like I feel so enlightened, but rather I feel so overwhelmed. And so that leads us to a place where we have to kind of, it's not like, oh, throw that out with the, you know, I think there's still a lot of baby to challenge it. It's not just bathwater, but we have to understand that it plays out today in a very different context of just this huge amount of information.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about that before getting on today. So one of my favorite content creators is Trust Radius. Mm-hmm. And these guys, I don't know if you're familiar with their publishing cycle, but every year they do a deep dive into the behaviors of buyers of SaaS product. And they don't publish a ton of that kind of content, but what they do publish was highly impactful. And I think it sort of speaks to that same idea of, you know, not trying to overwhelm people with volume, but influence them with quality, right? Influence them with actionable quality publishing that, you know, you can do something with.
I think that's right, Ken. I wrote an article, actually, it was a team-based effort from Gartner. It was one of the last things I published at Gartner in HBR called Sense Making for Sales. And it's really worth a read. It gets into this whole dynamic that we're talking about now, just customers being overwhelmed with information, the smartness arms race idea. And the thing, even for, you know, quality content from whichever shop it might come, I think the element that we didn't really address in the original Challenger, because it just wasn't relevant or just wasn't really on the radar screen, but today I would suggest is really relevant, is again, no matter how good your content might be, is helping your customers understand how it connects to other pieces of content. So put it into context, because there's no question they're out doing their due diligence and their research and their reading and their learning online, that we just know that that's just factually true. And there's a lot of data to back that up. So if you're the salesperson or the marketer, you know, the digital website, whatever, the person shows up, says, I know you've read a lot of white papers, but have you read my white paper? It's just like, oh God, I'll put it on the stack, right? So rather it's, I'm guessing you've read a lot of, you know, whether white papers, you've watched videos, you've seen these different websites, there's whatever the content might be, the form factor is not really so much relevant for us right now. But the question is, let me show you how we think about it. Let me show you how it fits in with these other two or three things. And as you put it all together, here's the top two or three questions you probably want to ask yourself to determine how it all fits and what's most relevant to you. So in other words, what I'm working almost like at the meta level. So I'm not just providing content, I'm providing content about the consumption of content. That's the meta level, right? So this is what I call frame making. I'm helping you put a framework around all that information, mine and third parties and advisory sites and competitors, just so you can just feel a little less overwhelmed. And as guidance around, here are the top two or three questions you should probably ask yourself. And maybe that's not just in my opinion. Ideally, it's, you know, working with other customers like you, one of the things we find is that there's probably boils down to three or four questions that they found to be most productive in helping them make progress. So now that I'm not just showing up giving you my opinion, I'm giving you social proof on companies like you and what they care about. And I'm giving you not just here's another white paper, but rather here's some helpful context for you to make sense out of all that information that's out there, because otherwise you're just going to go on this learning journey that never ends and you're going to wind up in status quo and overwhelmed and frustrated. So none of that was part of the original Challenger work, just frankly, because it didn't need to be. But I think today it's pretty critical.
And it's this content overload is only going to get worse, right?
It's 100%.
It's becoming too easy to churn out the words.
Yes.
So we have to, especially if you are in an advisor kind of role, help people put the frame around it, right? That's sort of, it's almost a requirement.
You know, there's a really interesting work that's being done by actually my co-author, Matt Dixon, and his team. They've got a little research shop called DCM Insights, and they've actually moved a little bit out of the world of sales, or in addition, maybe it's a better way of putting, in addition to the world of B2B selling, they're looking a lot at the world of partner sales. So like think law firms and accounting firms, consulting firms, literally where the people are the product, right? Because they're the experts, but they're also selling that product. And they're beginning to find some really interesting insights around what they're calling the activator role. And it's less about just showing up and challenging customers, thinking very much challenger-esque. That's a part of it. But it's this whole idea of connecting, putting things together for you, showing you how they work, connecting you to other people, to other expertise. And it goes back, I think, to, you know, they don't have a bar chart that shows this, but it reminds me a lot of something we found at Gartner that I still talk a lot about today, which is the in B2B sales and really B2B buying, the number one thing we have to solve for, then the data backs us up that we did at Gartner, is the degree to which customers feel confident in their ability to make large scale decisions on behalf of their company. So customer, what we call decision confidence, was by far the single biggest driver of what we called a high quality, low regret deal. It's essentially by far the single biggest driver of customers' likelihood to make a bigger purchase decision. And it stands to reason, in some ways, it's just super obvious, right? It feels very logical. If customers aren't confident in their ability to make a choice, they just won't choose. But when you start applying this concept and this data behind it, it gets really interesting. Because again, if I show up and say, here's what we think, and I just put on the pile with three other things from three other people, all think different things, what you've just done is undermined my confidence in making a decision. You've just made me more confused, more overwhelmed. And so I think if you start thinking about it from that perspective, Ken, it's like, what can I do? Not just to say, I know you've seen everyone else's insight, but have you seen my insight? Isn't super helpful. You're not going to be more confident. So how can I approach that conversation in such a way that I connect you to the context, I connect you to other people, so that I'm essentially playing a chess game around where checkmate is you feeling great about your ability to make a decision, right? It's like, how do I run that game? And that's different than how do I deliver my insight? Do you see what I'm saying? Ooh. And again, that's the thing that we have to solve for, isn't not the delivery of my insight. It is the creation of customer confidence.
So we didn't really chat about this, but yeah, made me think about work we used to do with our client Vodafone. Mm. And you know, they were selling a few $100 million global network deals.
Yeah.
And the truth is that the solutions for them, AT&T and British Telecommunications, I mean, these solutions looked remarkably the same with variations on, you know, are you fully own your own network in Spain or not? But
right.
I mean, the decisions didn't come down to the technology, the price, came down to the confidence. And mm-hmm. one of the tools we used to help them, and it was actually remarkably effective, was we would create these custom videos for each client deal.
Hmm.
And we would get the whole team on video. And, you know, these literally were $100 to $300 million contracts. So spending a little money on video was not a problem, but it was remarkably effective for the people making the decision to hear the personal commitment of everybody who was going to be on the solution delivery team and all the way up to the president, really the chairman of the Americas at the time for mm-hmm. Vodafone saying, you know, you have my personal commitment. This deal is going to be good for you. You know, you can trust my people to deliver on it because the technology was the same, right? The footprints were 97% the same. The price was within points. So what's the decider, right? It's your confidence, your belief that your partner's going to be there for you when it isn't perfect. So I wonder how you feel about that.
There's a nuance to this, which at least in the data you can see, and it may sound like I'm splitting hairs, but I think it's at least interesting to explore. But I love the idea, by the way. So let me back it up with some data. One of the things that we know that undermines customer confidence is their lack of confidence in their ability to implement whatever it is that they bought, right? So, you know, we're going to buy this multi-million-dollar solution or maybe $100,000, and again, pick your currency, and we're going to screw it up somehow. We're going to, you know, trip over ourselves in our own internal complexity and not roll it out effectively. And we're going to wind up a year, 2 years down the road, particularly in a renewable or recurring revenue model with a bunch of seats that we're not using or a bunch of technology that isn't performing. So we have a tendency, again, I like the video. Let me just give it a nuance. So the video is, look at all these people here to help you. And notice what you said, which is you can trust us, right? I think the nuance, which is even more interesting, is how can I help the customer feel like they can trust themselves, right? Because I've actually seen this. This happened to me, in fact, just a couple of weeks ago, where a company would say, no, I believe you guys that you're going to be there. It's not you I'm worried about. I'm worried about us. We'll screw this up somehow, right? So it's a little bit like that old Home Depot ads, like you can do it, we can help. But notice it's the you can do it, we can help. So we're here for you. We're here for you, but you can do this. And we're going to make sure that you can do this. And we're going to be there every step of the way on your journey. So watch the pronouns. The pronouns are all centered on the customer as opposed to on the suppliers. Like, we've got years of doing this. We can do this for you. We will help you. We will. It's less that. It's the you can do this. We will be there. So, you know, people always talk about, you know, you're not Luke Skywalker, you're Obi-Wan, right? It's a similar sort of thing, right? I don't know if you buy the nuance or if you feel like it's a distinction without a difference. But for that customer looks at you and says, no, I believe you guys will be here, but we'll screw it up anyway. That's what I need to solve for. It's how do I say, no. You can do this. And here's how we're bringing those sort of implementation teams in as part of the sale, for example, and mapping out that project plan and working with the PMO. If there is a PMO, a project management office, if there's a PMO involved, helping them understand how they can do this and that they have the capability. And of course, that you're there to support them. It's kind of a little bit to your point earlier. It's very psychological, isn't it? Right. This isn't just about see my product, love my product, particularly when those products are all the same, right? When you're working in a very commoditized environment, it's this who makes me feel better, not about them, but who makes me feel better about me or us. That I think is an underappreciated distinction. And this is why it's so important to solve for not customers' confidence in you, but customers' confidence in themselves. It seems so obvious when you first say it. Then you start looking at all these little nuanced angles and it gets really interesting, I think.
I think that might depend on the organization and the executive leadership on the project.
Yeah.
And it might be worth having two plays, right?
Yeah.
You have the play where, you know, you suss out that the organization needs to feel better about itself and its ability to execute. And the one where you have leadership that really knows its stuff and doesn't want that level of handholding. And I bet there's difference. Because I remember when I was a technologist a lifetime ago at Citi, I mean, I thought I was a master of the universe. I didn't really need help.
Right.
No, I'm serious. You know, I had this self-confidence, rightly or wrongly. I'm no longer a technologist. So, you know, who knows?
But actually, real quick, but I think that's where it goes full circle back to Challenger. And I think that's where Challenger is very relevant today, which is for someone in that position, for me to say, again, super diplomatically, professionally, socially, correctly, because, you know, handling prickly personalities, like, I know what I'm doing, just get out of my way and let me do it. How do I find a way to say, I hear you, and working with other customers like you, we found that this can go sideways in a really unexpected way. And let me just walk you through what we've seen. So it's evidence-based, because someone like that demands evidence, right? They demand not your expertise, but social proof. So it's evidence from other companies like you. But to show you how effectively what I need to do is look them in the eye and say, you're wrong. Right. But I just can never say it like that. And so it's a very delicate dance. But I do think that's where challenging that person's thinking, it matters in the sense of like otherwise, because if you don't, where are you? Well, it's like, if I know what I'm doing, just get away with it. Either I'm going to do it myself and don't need you at all, or I'm going to buy the cheapest option because they're all the same and it doesn't matter. So either you wind up with status quo or commoditization. And if you're okay with that, then just play the game. But if you're looking to sell at a premium, if you're looking to stand out and differentiate yourself, then I think then in that scenario, Challenger becomes actually pretty critical.
Yeah. I mean, I think looking back, you know, I certainly made decisions that were inventing at the time new ways for Citi to go to market. And I looked for partners that I thought I could learn from for sure, you know, who had some proof and they could lead me in a way. But I think it's a nuance, maybe, you know,
it's 100%.
How do you lead the prospect who thinks he or she can lead? Right. So it's an interesting situation.
Well, but notice at the heart of this, it's such a human thing we're talking about, right? This isn't really about selling per se. It's the same way you build friendships and marriages and things like that. Like, how do I interact with you such that interaction doesn't make you feel better about me? But how do I interact with you such that that interaction makes you feel better about you? And by the way, you could be lots of different versions of you. So understanding that is like jujitsu, right? Or it's like Vulcan chess. It's actually quite hard, but it's so powerful. I think this is why the best sellers are the best sellers. This is why they make seven figures or even higher sometimes, is because not that they've tapped into a process or a methodology, but they've tapped into empathy and they've tapped into the power of understanding how to show up in such a way that helps people feel better about themselves. But by the way, they're also the most, that's what the great politicians do. I think it's what great marriages are based on, right? It's like great friendships. You know, it's one of those things like, Ken, I love you. But really, Ken, I love you not because I love you. I love you because I love me when I'm around you. Like, if you could be that person, that's powerful.
It's interesting. Do you follow Brian Burns, the sales speaker?
No.
Oh, yeah. He's very much about this. You know, what makes a great seller is that ability to channel empathy, not smiles and dials, right?
100%.
You know, he rails against metric-based selling because he feels, and I think he's absolutely right, that's not where the action is.
Oh, this is Brian Carroll. I'm sorry.
No, it's Brian Burns. Brian Burns.
Brian Burns. Okay. Well, because
this one I remembered right. This one.
Oh no, it's all good. No, so actually, so I have a very good friend, Brian Carroll, who also talks a lot about this in sales training. So that's very cool. I guess this is like a Brian thing. I don't know, but Brian Carroll is fabulous. So anyway, yeah.
Well, he has a whole consultancy on this kind of stuff.
Awesome. Very cool.
Yeah.
You know, this idea of empathy, by the way, is also core to Challenger. In fact, it's like there's a little Easter egg I planted in the very back of the Challenger Customer, which is the second of the two books in the acknowledgments. I mean, that's buried, but in the acknowledgments, you're thanking people. I was thanking my family, my daughters, and there's a line that said something effective, may you grow up to embody the principle that sits at the heart and soul of this entire book, which is the principle of empathy. And so that's the whole book pivots on empathy. And yet the word empathy doesn't show up in the book anywhere. But this whole idea of if I'm going to change the way a customer thinks about their business, in fact, actually, Ken, I used to ask this people all the time, it's a fun exercise. Ken, if I'm going to change the way a customer thinks about their business, what's the first thing I have to understand? Most people will say, well, I got to understand their business, which seem, you know, you read their 10Qs and their 10Ks and listen to the reports and, you know, the annual report and all that kind of stuff and read the financials. That is to some degree true. However, it's, again, it's nuanced, but if I'm going to change the way a customer thinks about their business, the first thing I need to understand is how they think about their business. Do you see what I'm saying? I have to get in their minds and understand their mental model. How do they think it works? Whether they're right or wrong, I have to build, at CB, we used to call this the member model because our customers were members, right? So we'd essentially build out a customer's mental model and understand how do they make those connections? What are the causal links of, you know, from profitability top all the way down to specific tactics? So that's empathy, right? I have to kind of get in their head and think about how they think about their business. Because then once I understand how they think about their business, I could show them different or better or alternate ways to think about their business. And that's where Challenger comes in. But at the heart and soul, I think that's an exercise in empathy, right? It's seeing the world from someone else's perspective. And figuring out, and this is where empathy can go off the rails pretty badly too, though, Ken, because it can become very, how can I manipulate that? Right? It's like, I had long debates with people like Brian Carroll around, is empathy always good, right? Or can empathy be used for bad or ill?
Is there a dark side?
Right, exactly, right. I think at the end of the day, it comes down to how you define the term. So maybe it's kind of a, you know, it's a definitional question. But one way or another, this is, again, going back to where we were, I think why the best salespeople are the best salespeople is because they understand how their customers thinks about their world and operates at that level. They don't operate at the, here's math, as we were talking about before, or here's a feature or a benefit. They operate at the world of, let me help you think differently. Let me help you perceive things a little differently about yourself, about your company, about your world, such that you take action on it. That's a powerful place to play.
So I just want to kind of hold the thought for a moment for people that listen this far in the episode. This might have a profound impact on how you recruit your salespeople, like the skills you're looking for. You don't need a demo god. You probably need someone who can build trust and understanding and a bridge to like a shared vision. And as you're interviewing them, you want them to do that to you, right? You want them to take you down that path.
Yeah.
I think would be a beautiful thing if you could find that person.
You know, in the early days of Challenger, we built out hiring guides and all, you know, recruiting guides and internal promotion guides. I can be honest, I don't know if any of that stuff still exists or not, if the Challenger company would have it, if it does. But some of it we put in the book and like hinted at. But there was a couple of years, I don't know, probably around 2012, 13, 14, where I was traveling around the world with the Challenger work and having discussions with chief sales officers about the best profile to hire. And there was this general consensus. They'd say, well, you know, like business school, whatever. So everyone would always say like, but I got this one person on my team who used to be a math teacher or an English teacher or a teacher seemed to, or, you know, something completely different. And, oh my God, they're killing it. And so, because I think what we're tapping into here is this human element, right? This empathy element, which may present itself in traditional sales training, but maybe not. It may present itself in other places like teaching or something completely different. You won't find it among engineers. Forget it there. No, I'm just kidding.
I have a friend who used to be a programmer with me at IBM. We started together quite a long time ago. And he ended up becoming a consultant building customizations to ERP. Mm-hmm. And he did that for about 8 or 10 years. And it was all about really understanding how to make the software do what it needed to do. And he became a salesperson.
Yeah.
He's one of SAP's like consistently top performers now.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. And it's all about that, having spent so many years listening and trying to get people where they want to go. His empathy is off the chart.
It's a powerful combination too, because engineers, very much like mathematicians and physicists and, you know, left brain numbers driven people, logic driven people will question things, right? And so you put that empathy together with this ability to question, like an empathetic contrarian.
So that's the next book. That's the title of the next book, yeah, right?
That's Money in the Bank right there. That's the, probably not for me, but for someone. But I think that's a really powerful place to come from, is an empathetic contrarian. I love that. I've just landed on that. I'm going to write that down. That's good stuff. But go ahead. Sorry, Ken.
It's great stuff. I'm going to ask you to bear with me as we come down to earth a little bit.
Sure. Oh, God. That's
a lot of the folks listening are practitioners, right? They're the people on the 100%. Front line, as we discussed really early on. And, you know, we take a look at a lot of people's websites, their web properties, and they seem to all make very similar mistakes, right? They're coming at it from who we are, what we do, all about us. And I'm wondering if you have any guidance for people, first of all, understand if they're actually making that mistake. You know, they don't probably need outside help. And how do they steer that ship?
So I did some of this seems so long ago now, 2017. So that's like forever ago. And pre-pandemic, I did a keynote at the time it was still the CEB sales and marketing conference around website design, which kind of blew everyone's mind a little bit, because I kind of held them out to task and they are like, guilty as charged, because we all build the same website, right? It's based on this concept of broadcasting. No one's ever said that out loud, but if you just kind of look at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of websites, as we did back then, you find that they all kind of look the same. It's like, the reason I got to build a website is to broadcast to the world, here I am, look at me, right? So it's kind of three elements: who we are, what we do, and how we help. So who we are is we are a values-driven company. We believe in the environment, diversity. There's probably science, technology. We're smart. There's oftentimes, like, if you're in logistics, there's that truck coming at you with the sun setting behind it with the light. You know, if you're in med device or in biosciences, there's a person in the lab coat holding the Erlenmeyer flask up to the light with the glowing green liquid. It's like, everybody's like, who we are. And then there's what we do. So then there's the, here's all our solutions and all our configurations and how, you know, aligned by industry vertical or geography or whatever it might be. And then, so that's who we are, what we do, and how we help is, you know, all the different like logos and the win stories and the customer testimonials. And again, I guess it must be okay because we're all doing it, right? So it's like, but it's just not differentiated, one. But two, notice it's also supplier centric. It's like who we are, what we do, how we help. It's like enough about me. Now let's spend a little more time on this website talking about me, right? But if the thing we got to solve for isn't customers' confidence in you, but customers' confidence in themselves, how could you create a website that is a place for customers to learn, not about you, but to learn about their own business? So every time that we ever did anything at CEB and Gartner around sense making or what we called buyer enablement or challenger, my question was always the same, which is like, how do we do this digitally? So everything was originally denominated, most of it was originally denominated in seller behavior. But just because that's how human beings are best suited to interact with customers doesn't mean you could create a digital equivalent of that somehow. And whenever you went through that mental exercise, you wound up with a website that looked completely different than the websites we all create. So going back to the value conversation, for example, is one of the reasons why I came to Eco, because I kind of dig what we're doing here with the platform, is I can create an environment on a website that allows people to come and figure out, what should my objectives be? What are other companies like me doing? What have I not thought of but should think about? Notice that's not like, hey, I want to know more about this company, whether they were founded in 1872 in the back of a pickup truck. I'm trying to figure out on your website what I should be doing, right? Not what you already are doing. How do I figure out the tactics to pursue? What would be the kinds of metrics I might consider? And ultimately, you'll build out a business case for that. I think marketers have started leaning into interactivity on their websites probably in about 2017, 2018. And so there's a lot of talk about interactive websites. But you think about in the B2C environment, like if I'm buying a car, it's one of the things I can configure the entire car. So like configurators, things like that are pretty common now, at least some parts of B2B. But again, if you start thinking about this empathetic perspective of contrarian empathy, which is this idea that I could teach on my website, I could show you, I can frame on my website, it can help you feel more confident in yourself on my website. Man, Ken, I just think all of that's just so untapped. Like, we need to have a, you know, the truck with the sun and the person with the test tube. That's kind of where we're at right now.
Well, I think that was a great challenge for people revisiting their web properties or wondering why their websites aren't contributing. So I think that was a great way to frame it. Thank you for the frame.
Well, you know, by the way, so in SaaS in particular, because we're all doing the same thing. So, and the demo, I mean, that's the thing in SaaS we all do. It's like, we need to have a digital demo on our website that allows people to come self-serve on the demo. But again, notice it's all completely supplier centric, right? How do I create, right? And I'm not suggesting we shouldn't do those things, But there's this whole other side to things that we're just leaving sitting there, right? Which if customers are coming to our website saying, I want to see this thing in action, then a demo makes sense. But if they're also coming to your website and other websites at Google and Gartner and advisory companies trying to figure out, like, what should I even be doing in the first place? Am I even asking the right questions? How do I know what content to be looking at? How can I create a digital experience that helps address those concerns in addition to, I want to see your product in action?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. The scenario might be, hey, I've got this core system. It's 12 years old.
Right.
I know it's not working. What do I do now? Right. That's a
Do I need to change it? Is this urgent? Am I in trouble? You know, like at risk? Right. What are the costs involved? How much is this going to cost me? Right. Like, what are the alternatives, whether in technology, like on-prem or cloud or whatever it might be? Or what's the role of AI in all this now, of course? So what I'm going to do is, of course, I'm going to Google it or whatever. I'm going to use some search strings, or now maybe I'll ask ChatGPT or whatever. I don't know. But the last thing that would occur to me is I should go to a supplier website to learn about these answers, because really all I'm going to get there is, again, Truck, Sunset, Labcoat, and Erlenmeyer Flask. So why even bother going to a supplier website? Imagine if, though, you created a digital experience where that could happen. We've seen a couple of companies do that. It's incredibly powerful.
Yeah, we didn't get to all my questions, but we've run real long. So maybe that's a good place to land it. I want to thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Brent, if people want to reach out to you and learn more about Eco, how can they do that?
So the website is ecosystems.io. Probably the easiest, quickest way to find me is on LinkedIn. I seem to hang out there quite often. So reach out and I'm there.
Awesome. Thank you. And if people want to find me on LinkedIn, it's linkedin.com/in/KenLempit. If you haven't subscribed to the podcast, well, shame on you. And you can do so anywhere podcasts are distributed. Brent Adamson, thank you so much for being on the podcast. We're big fans of your work and hope to run into you again soon.
Awesome, Ken. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the SaaS Backwards Podcast, brought to you by Austin Lawrence Group. We're a growth marketing agency that helps SaaS firms reduce churn, accelerate sales, and generate demand. Learn more about us at www.austinlawrence.com. You can email Ken Lempit at kl@austinlawrence.com about any SaaS marketing or customer retention subject. We hope you'll subscribe, and thanks again for listening.